This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Cartographies of Time, a reading and presentation by historians Daniel Rosenberg and Anthony Grafton, drawing from their book of the same title. It took place on April 15th, 2010.
Good evening, if I can have your attention. I'm Sina Najafi, editor-in-chief of Cabinet Magazine, and I'm very happy that you could make it here tonight for this event to celebrate the publication of Cartographies of Time, published by Princeton Architecture Press, which just came out this month. And there are copies of this incredibly beautiful and amazing book over there if you haven't seen it. And this is an event that is especially close to our hearts for a whole number of reasons. And I'll only mention two of them, which are the two gentlemen sitting to my right. Daniel Rosenberg, one of the authors of the book, has been a participant in the magazine since issue one, and has been an editor of the magazine for a long time. And in issue 13, which he guest edited, which had a thematic section on histories of the future, he produced a timeline of timelines that we published over six pages. A revised edition of that timeline of timelines with some new material is available there. You'll see it in poster form. It's what we couldn't do at the time in the magazine because we couldn't afford a poster. But it's available now, finally, and it looks absolutely incredible. I'd like to thank Alexander Zygmunt and Anya Kaplan-Seam for their help on producing the poster. And also, enormous thanks to Alexandra for the timeline of food that you'll see there, and I hope you've been enjoying that as well. But back to the two gentlemen on my right, I asked Tony just now, Tony Grafton, professor of history at Princeton, co-author of the book, when it was that he published a an article on the history of the footnote in Lingua Franca. It turned out to be 1999, and that was the first time that I had read Tony, and it was an incredibly seminal event for me. To look at this tiny little apparatus and open up a whole world through it was an amazing lesson for me. And so it's an especial pleasure to welcome both Dan and Tony here tonight. They're going to talk you a little bit through the book, and I'm going to hand over the mic. Please join me in welcoming them.
It's really remarkable to be here on this side of the podium. I've been to a lot of Cabinet events out there and some back there, but I've never been up here. And I thank you all for coming. I could say the same things about Sina and Cabinet that he said about us, which is that for a decade now, Cabinet has been really a revelation. And every interaction I've had with Cabinet has been important and course-changing in some way for me. And the timeline of timelines is only one great example. You know, it was, I don't know if it was here or at a bar or where it was. I was collecting timelines at the time and somebody said, wouldn't it be funny to make a timeline of timelines? And in most conversations, such a thing would end up just as bar conversation, but at Cabinet, it becomes literature. So the story of this book is kind of a story of two parallel timelines, mine and Tony's. We have been aware of each other for a long time, but before we started work on this book, we hadn't worked together before, and that experience was also something of a revelation. When I think about what this book is, I think of the Cabinet timeline of timelines as a kind of sourdough starter or something. And then I think of the Princeton University Library that Tony invited me to come down to Princeton to work with him. And I think about that as the medium, which was then fermented somehow by the Cabinet starter, and what we have is the book. So at any rate, you're all here to either listen to us read from the book about a somewhat arcane and apparently dry subject, or else to get drunk and eat fascinating food. And so for those of you who came for the latter purpose, I apologize. You have two university professors up here, and so we're going to hit your heads with the book for a few minutes. For those of you who actually came to hear the reading, you're remarkable. A couple of words about the book, and then what we'll do, kind of Passover style, is we'll switch back and forth in the reading. We'll take you through from the book. It's mostly focused on the print era, but we start with some discussion of ancient chronologies because it sets up the story. And so I'll begin by talking a little bit about the ancient stuff and then the early modern, and then I'll hand it over to Tony, who will talk about two or three of the modern figures. And so we'll just, it's hard to hold it all together because it's a big book with a lot of stuff, but I think that, these kind of points of reference will give you a sense of where we're going. The thing I wanted to say about the book just before we begin is it is a history book, a history of chronologies, a history of timelines. It's also just a kind of thought experiment. Tiki Barber has been in the news this week. We have nothing to say about that. We selected this image a long, long time before Tiki showed his this side of his personality. But the question, in a sense, the question the book seeks to answer is, why is it that a graphic designer, Nicole Michaels, could sketch the laces of a football? This is a Wall Street Journal advertisement trying to link the journal with up-and-coming personalities in the business world. And there's series, there's one on Jake Burton, the snowboarding guy, there's one on Sheryl Crow. This one is Tiki Barber, and in each one, she abstracts some image from the sort of life career of the person. In this one, she takes the laces of the football, since Tiki was a football player, and takes away the football, so all you see is the laces. And the question is, how is it in the modern world that you can show a picture of a football and what we see is a timeline? How is it that the form of the timeline became so natural to us that we see it even when it's not there? So with that said, Tony's going to start with a selection from the introduction, and then I'll come back with some of the characters.
So thank you all for being here. I have to say, when you write a book about chronology, which is the kind of noun that usually appears after the adjective mere, you know, it's a very abstract, dry subject with hundreds of illustrations covering hundreds of years, you don't expect that a lot of people will turn out on a beautiful spring evening to hear about it. And it's not the subject you'd expect to draw people, and it's two professors, and you know professors are liable when asked what's most interesting about their book to say everything and start at the beginning and go to the end, and you've all braved these horrors, so thank you. What we really believe, I think, after years of hard work, is that timelines are actually endlessly weird and fascinating. And the more of them we've found and the more of them we've looked at, the more fascinating they've become, and the richer and more complicated the story of their visual grammar as it evolves over time. And that's the thread. That's really the timeline of which holds our book together. What does history look like? How do you draw time? While historical texts have long been subject to critical analysis, the formal and historical problems posed by graphic representation of time have largely been ignored. This is no small matter. Graphic representation is among our most important tools for in organizing information. Yet little has ever been written about historical charts and diagrams. And for all of the excellent work that's been recently published in the history and theory of cartography, we have few examples of critical work in the area of what Aviatar Zerubbabel has called time maps. This book is an attempt to address that gap. In many ways, this work is a reflection on lines. Straight and curved, branching and crossing, simple and embellished, technical and artistic, the basic components of historical diagrams. Our claim is that the line is a much more complex and colorful figure than is usually thought. Historians will probably appreciate this aspect of the book fairly easily. We all use simple line diagrams in our classrooms, what we usually call timelines, to great effect. We get them, our students get them, they translate wonderfully from weighty analytic history books to thrilling narrative ones. But simple and intuitive as they seem, these timelines are not without a history themselves. They were not always here to help us in our lectures. They haven't always taken the forms that we unthinkingly give them. They're such a familiar part of our mental furniture that it's sometimes hard to remember that we ever had acquired them in the first place. But we did. And the story of how is worth telling because it helps us understand where our contemporary conceptions of history come from, how they work, and especially how they rely on visual forms. It's also worth telling because it's a good story full of turns and twists and unexpected characters soon to be revealed. Another reason for the gap in our historical and theoretical understanding of timelines is the relatively low status that we usually grant to chronology as a kind of study. Though we use chronologies all the time and couldn't do without them, we typically see them as only distillations of complex historical narratives and ideas. Chronologies work, and as far as most people are concerned, that's enough. But as we'll show in this book, it wasn't always so. From the classical period to the Renaissance in Europe, chronology was among the most revered of scholarly pursuits. Indeed, in some respects, it held a status higher than that of history itself. While history dealt in stories, chronology dealt in facts. Moreover, the facts of chronology had significant implications outside of the academic study of history. For Christians, getting chronology right was the key to many practical matters, such as knowing when to celebrate Easter, and weighty ones, such as knowing when the apocalypse was nigh.
Okay, I'm gonna read from two sections of the book. The first is from the second chapter, and it's gonna take us from the 4th century AD to the early print era. So I put a few passages together. It's a lot real fast. I apologize for the whiplash. And the second I'll read deals with the graphic innovations that were sparked by the intellectual and technological innovations of the early modern period. Okay, so bear with me, beginning at the beginning. The story of the timeline begins in the ancient world. Greek and Roman scholars drew up lists of priests, Olympic winners, and magistrates, some of which were carved in stone, others recorded in books. But it was the 4th century Christian theologian Eusebius of Caesarea who designed and composed the chronicle that became the model for later timelines for centuries to come. Eusebius set out to establish the place of Christianity in the history of the world, told in part by the Jewish and the Christian scriptures. But he also planned to synchronize with this central narrative the histories of several other nations that had maintained their own records and their own conventions of chronology, and that had figured prominently in the history of ancient Israel and the formation of the modern church. Eusebius, who read the Bible in Greek, knew and used the Hexapla, a 6-column polyglot Bible that another Christian scholar, Origen, had compiled in the 3rd century. By lining up the original Hebrew word for word with other columns that provided a Greek transliteration and 4 different Greek translations, Origen enabled Christian readers to see where their Greek Bible, which they had inherited from the Greek-speaking Jews of Alexandria, differed from the Hebrew Bible that was used by the Jews of Palestine. This very long, famous edition probably filled 20 complete manuscripts. But it proved the critical potential of rows and columns, formats that had been much harder to use in rolls, the original books used by the ancients, than they were in the codex books that the Christians favored. This format provided Eusebius, as it had Origen, with a simple device for processing complex information. And I'll point out that we're looking at a 5th century copy of Eusebius's Chronicle, so you can see the rows and the columns at work. 19 parallel columns, one to a nation, trace the rise and fall of the ancient Assyrians, Egyptians, and Persians, as well as the Greeks and Romans, who still ruled the world. Eusebius coordinated all of these histories, making clear, for example, that the Greek philosopher Thales and the Hebrew prophet Jeremiah had been near contemporaries. Eusebius's image of history taught one central lesson. Over time, the multiple kingdoms that had ruled parts of the world disappeared. History funneled down into a single story, that of how Rome unified the world just in time to give the Messiah access to all of his peoples. The Chronicle, in other words, was more than a highly legible record. It was a dynamic hieroglyph of providential history. Translated into Latin and revised by Jerome in the 5th century, the Chronicle found a long series of copyists, continuators, and imitators through late antiquity and the Middle Ages. Over and over again, scholars brought the Chronicle up to date, while scribes made adjustments in its format. The Chronicle was also one of the first books published in print, and it was highly popular in the first era of print. Yet some of the Chronicles, this is Eusebius in print in the 16th century, and you see the same format, but now regulated by printing. Yet some chronicles composed after printing was invented, including Carthusian Werner Rolovink's best-selling Fasciculus Temporum, or Bundle of Dates, of 1474, and Nuremberg humanist Hartmann Schedel's lavishly illustrated 1493 Nuremberg Chronicle, offered readers more complex and vivid images of the past. Schedel and Rolovink both knew, as readers of Eusebius did, that from their inception, universal histories were graphic enterprises. They used a wide range of graphic devices, old and new, to portray the course of history. For example, Schedel, in 1493, portrayed many of his hundreds of actors as the literal fruit of elaborate genealogical trees. He illustrated his work with a Ptolemaic map of the world, dazzling perspective renderings of ancient and modern cities, and even handsome comic strip images of wild races of cannibals and dog-headed men that had been reported in India since ancient times. Though his book could not match the visual clarity and precision of Rolovink's timeline, it offered far more detailed verbal and visual depictions of the past. Schedel, a citizen of Nuremberg, a great merchant city and a prime node on Europe's communication networks, knew that his readers were experiencing history in new ways through new media. Where the earlier parts of Schedel's Nuremberg Chronicle followed the stately tempo of traditional world histories, the later ones with their gripping images of a naked witch flying, Jews murdering a Christian child, and the events foretold in the Book of Revelation represented history as a kaleidoscopic mass of places and events hurtling forward till its end. Schedel even gave readers a few blank pages, I haven't reproduced them, between the end of their own time and the apocalypse that they could fill in, and many did, with what he clearly expected to be the very short remaining history of the world. Eusebius had warned his readers that humans could not know when time began or where it would end. Schedel, by contrast, set firm borders at both ends of his map. Early modern chronologers promised their readers, as Eusebius had, that they would provide a kind of Rosetta Stone, a tool that would permit them to translate lists of names and dates from many different sources and languages into a single coherent vision of the past. The urgency of such work, of course, varied greatly in relation to the eschatological position of the reader. For some, and this is true to the present day, the study of chronology was motivated by the desire to discover the exact and coming date of the apocalypse. Others bore in mind the words of the resurrected Jesus to his followers, "It is not for you to know the times or seasons which the Father hath put in his own power." For them, the end of time was not a collective experience of horror and rapture, but something every individual encountered in his own life. Okay. So this is a brief look at the ancient period going through the invention of printing. And what follows next in the book is a section which we're not going to read from. I'm going to run through a couple of pictures of, and Tony in particular, me too, would be delighted to expand on these at length when we have alcohol in our hands. But what happens after Schedel and Rolovink is a kind of profusion of experiments with different ways of representing time, many of which turn out to be historical dead ends, some of which are fabulously interesting, but most of which don't have strong legacies in the modern period. Things like this chronological calculator on the palm of your hand to help you remember former rulers. This image, which has lots and lots of modern versions, the statue of Daniel. And on Daniel, you can read the history of the world. On the statue that Daniel dreamed, you can read the history of the world. Genealogies and portrayals of successions of empires in all kinds of crazy shapes. Images of the world conceptualized, of world history conceptualized as a clock face on which the hand only has to return to 12 o'clock and we reach the apocalypse. You see how close the hand is. Images like these from Johannes Kepler, the astronomer, which are allegorical representations of history. Archaeological representations like this one from the 18th century Italian writer Bianchini. And this wonderful allegorical system by the history teacher Johannes Bruno, who is only remembered because he taught history to Johann Sebastian Bach. The most successful of all of the experiments in this period were the combinations of astronomy and chronology. And here you have an image from the 16th century astronomer Petrus Appianus. The concept here was that chronological controversies could be solved if you looked at the history of astronomical events, which could be viewed from different nations with different literary traditions all at the same time. So all of that is just a quick sketch of some of the things that take place between what I was reading and what I'm about to read as we start to get into experiments which did have a strong legacy in the age of the graphical representation of statistical data. So, to continue. In retrospect, it seems obvious that the structures chronologers invented in the 16th century would fall apart in the 17th. There was simply no way to negotiate the differences among so many historical traditions, and astronomy could not adjudicate nearly as many points as Appianus or Joseph Scaliger had hoped. At the time, however, most scholars remained optimistic and continued to try to devise a single chronological equivalent to Ptolemaic or modern world maps. They found individual problems insoluble. Their enterprise as a whole retained great energy and appeal, and innovation never ceased. Already in the 16th century, chronologers had begun experimenting with new tabular forms and applications. Some even tried to provide graphic expressions of chronological data, charts that not only listed information, but represented it in ways that made it easy to grasp. The Lutheran theologian Lorenz Codeman, for example, synchronized the lives of the biblical patriarchs in a tabular format similar to that used in the modern road atlas. His table, printed in 1596, lists the names of the patriarchs twice, once horizontally across the top of the page and once vertically in the left margin. By lining up the names from the two axes on the table, the reader could instantly find the age of one biblical figure at the birth or the death of another. Though the design is tabular, Kottman's table edges in the direction of a more fully graphic form of representation, which makes the chronology of the patriarchs clearer than the old tables could. Since he fills boxes only when he has information to put in them, the table functions as a kind of accidental bar chart. On it, columns of data are as long as the lives of the figures they represent. As such, they provide not only a tool for calculating specific ages, but also a view of the entire unbroken tradition by which historical knowledge was understood to have been passed down to Moses. Similarly, and this is my last example, the French chronologer Johannes Temporarius, the impossibly named Johannes Temporarius, used graphics to deal with a problem that long bothered everyone who tried to draw the history of the world from the Bible. According to Genesis, only Noah's family survived the flood. And yet, within a few generations, they and their descendants had repopulated the world so effectively that men tried to build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Was such explosive population growth even possible? Europeans, whose society still regularly suffered from the blows of plague and famine, found it hard to believe. But Temporarius found the account plausible. At the top of his diagram, a horizontal axis represented the first period of time after the flood, divided into 20-year intervals. The reader could watch the population as it grew generation by generation. Similar questions had arisen about whether the Jews could have multiplied as quickly during their time in Egypt as the biblical account suggested, but Temporarius answered them with another visual display of demographic growth. Yet if Temporarius was experimenting with something like modern bar charts, he applied them only to countable individuals. He juxtaposed linear graphic forms with chronological information, but he didn't graph time. Temporarius was a radical when it came to the substance of chronology. He dismissed the story of Rome's founding by Romulus as traditional dating, as mere myth fashioned centuries after the events. But he found no way to give his innovative ideas about historical time an actual graphic form. It took longer than might have been expected for chronologers to progress from creating tables that contained information, like the ones that we've been looking at, to those that expressed information, and those Tony gets to tell you about.
So the experimenting goes on, especially in the 17th century with the rise of engraving, which gives new possibilities for all kinds of graphic exercises. And yesterday, presenting this in Princeton, we were able to show some of the actual products of this, including a couple of enormous late 17th, early 18th century books. But take our word for it, there's a lot of them. They experiment in all kinds of interesting ways. But the real hinge of our account, the turning point, comes in the 18th century, and it really is very much tied to the European Enlightenment. And though several characters play important roles in this story, the chief one is the person who would become well known as a scientist, theologian, and the discoverer of dephlogisticated air, Joseph Priestley. Priestley brought to the timeline the vision of a scientist. He was the first chronographer to conceptualize his charts in terms similar to those of scientific illustration, and he was the first to lay out systematic principles for the translation of historical data into a visual medium. Priestley's charts were elegant and big, more than 3 feet wide and 2 feet tall. The chart of biography was large enough to accurately register the births and deaths of 2,000 famous historical figures, virtually all of them men, across 3,000 years in universal time. The new chart of history displayed the fates of 78 important kingdoms and empires during the same period. Both works could be purchased as posters or as scrolls wound up on rollers, and they were aggressively marketed by Priestley's London publisher. Priestley designed his charts for the curiosity and pleasure of a general reader, but they were also meant to serve the scholar, and Priestley believed that the two aims were well served by the same approach. Faced with these charts, Priestley said, any child could recognize the error of the tasteless chronologer who through tortured calculations had managed to separate the lovers Dido and Danaus by more than 300 years. A simple visual demonstration, said Priestley, would be enough to put an end to a controversy that had worried commentators on Virgil since the time of Petrarch, at least. Priestley's charts are masterpieces of visual economy. Both the chart of biography and the new chart of history obey strict graphic conventions. Along their top and bottom edges, the charts are marked, and you can see this just about. It's really hard to show these things, but we are lucky in the quality of our reproductions. You can see they're marked at intervals of 100 years. Between the century marks, tiny dots, which you really can't see, indicate decades. Dates inscribed at top and bottom are connected by vertical grid lines that make the charts easy to read, make synchronisms easy to find. In addition, the chart of biography, maybe we should go back to that, is divided into six horizontal bands representing areas of life achievement. The uppermost is devoted, naturally, to historians, antiquaries, and lawyers. The next to orators and critics, artists and poets, mathematicians and physicians, divines and metaphysicians, and finally, at the very bottom of the chart, statesmen and warriors. The interior of the chart of biography is filled with about 2,000 small solid black horizontal lines representing the lives of famous individuals. When Priestley was certain of dates of death and birth, he began and ended these lines cleanly at the appropriate places in the chart. When he was uncertain, he began or ended a line with an ellipse. Even these ellipses, though, were carefully drawn. When it is said that a writer flourished at or about a particular time, says Priestley, a short full line is drawn about two-thirds before and one-third after that particular time, with three dots before and two dots after it. Because, in general, men are said to flourish much nearer the time of their death than the time of their birth. The biographical chart displays a striking simplicity of form. Priestley meant his chart to be an ocular demonstration of the mathematical principles that Isaac Newton had applied in his own posthumously published chronological writings. There, Newton argued that many chronological controversies could be settled if the distance between generations were estimated according to mathematical principles. One of his followers, John Craig, even tried to work out rules to express the rate at which historical sources lost their probative value over time. In Priestley's chart, these averages display themselves everywhere, just, he says, as the uniformity of the course of nature requires. The new chart of history is identical to the chart of biography in size and scale, begins and ends at the same dates, and has, running along its bottom edge, the same list of rulers, beginning with the Hebrews and culminating, of course, with the modern kings of England. Priestley hoped that this common scale would make the two charts easy to use together. Though they could not literally be superimposed, they could be placed side by side for comparison. And, as Priestley notes, readers might very easily inscribe on one chart information drawn from the other. As with the chart of biography, Priestley promoted the new chart of history as a tool to appeal to the mind directly through the senses. In contrast to chronology books, which required great mental labor, the new chart of history was designed to give the student the feeling of seeing history in action. Priestley writes, "If the reader carry his eye vertically, he will see the contemporary state of all the empires subsisting in the world, as you do, with real areas to give a sense of their temporal existence. He may observe which were then rising, which were flourishing, and which were upon the decline. Casting his eye a little on each side of the vertical line, he will say what empires had lately gone off the stage and which were about to come on." Priestley emphasizes that this experience comes without reading. He makes only one significant concession to the limitations of the simple linear graphic. He adds color to the new chart of history, an innovation that allows him to exhibit the unity of empires that cannot be represented by continuous spaces. Both of Priestley's charts perform impressive feats of condensation. In fact, they're so dense that they're very hard to reproduce well. And when displayed one part at a time, electronically, on film, or in print, the aggregating effects of the whole can easily be lost. According to Priestley, the charts had the special characteristics of communicating chronological relationships all at one view. In this way, they expressed the potential of the graphic image and amplified the virtues of historical study itself. In the charts, as in history, wrote Priestley, the whole is before us. We see men and things at their full length, as we may say, and we likewise generally see them through a medium which is less partial than that of experience. For decades, Priestley's charts were heavily used, and accounts of them appear throughout the pedagogical literature of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. They were, according to the Cambridge Magazine, an essential part of any gentleman's library. Both the novelist Maria Edgeworth and the physician Erasmus Darwin, grandfather to Charles, recommended them as aids in the education of women. By the early 19th century, Priestley's charts had become an easily recognizable part of print culture. An 1818 children's book about the dangers of distraction, called Harry's Holiday, hinges on a young boy's failed attempt to hand copy one of Priestley's charts, a foolish effort which occasions a lecture from his father on the virtues of mechanical reproduction. But the fictional Harry was far from alone, and manuscript copies of historical charts from the 18th century can still be found in libraries and archives. Some of these are rote student work, others, like Harry's, are the product of individual initiative. A manuscript historical chart in the manner of Priestley's New Chart of History, made around 1800, can be found in the papers of John Dickinson, first governor of the state of Delaware. And a copy of Priestley's chart of Hebrew chronology from the 18th century can still be found slipped inside a Priestley volume held at the Library Company of Philadelphia, an early circulating library founded by Benjamin Franklin in 1731. For Priestley, the essential aim of the chronological chart was to give a broad view. From a distance, to use his own analogy, the lines on the chart of biography should look like so many small straws swimming on the surface of an immense river, bunching and drifting apart as the currents of history change speed. So the chart is densest at the far right edge, that's to say, in recent history. This is no accident of design. According to Priestley, the noblest prospect is suggested by a view of the crowds of names in the divisions appropriated to the arts and sciences in the last two centuries. Here all the classes of renown, and I might add of merit, are full, and 100 times as many might have been admitted of equal attainments in knowledge with their predecessors. This prospect gives a kind of security for the continual propagation and extension of knowledge, and that for the future, no more great chasms of men, really eminent for knowledge, will ever disfigure the part of the chart of their lives which I cannot draw or ever see drawn. In other words, in Priestley's view, the mass of straws accumulated at the right represents an actual historical phenomenon, the acceleration of the arts and sciences in his own time. On the chart of biography, Priestley writes, what a figure must science make? And indeed, in Priestley's chart, something called science literally takes on a figure, perhaps for the first time. Now, a magnificent image. The Dark Ages appear as spots of light. It's wonderfully paradoxical. And what you really get in the end is the 18th century vision of progress, time moving faster and faster and going to move still faster in the time that we don't quite live to see. Well, in the 19th century, as many of you, we hope, will find by reading, there is lots more chronology, chronology for education, chronology for fun, Mark Twain's patented chronological games, many magnificent forms of chronological fun and profit. But to close, we'll move you into the 20th century and into the period when, as Dan started by noting, the timeline not only infiltrates but proliferates unexpectedly in the work of art, and in works of art by the most radically different artists, from Steinberg to Basquiat, both of whom were absolutely obsessed by timelines and worked them into their work in multiple ways. Chronology began to infiltrate the territory of art itself in the 1930s. In 1936, Alfred H. Barr, the founding director of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, published his influential book, Cubism and Abstract Art, a companion to an exhibition by the same name. The exhibition was notable in many ways.
It marked the first time that many seminal modernist works were displayed in the United States. It made a strong case for the role of Cubism in the development of modernism, and it inaugurated a series of exhibitions on different aspects of modern art that would help define the mission of the Museum of Modern Art. Moreover, it was the first American exhibition to provide a comprehensive view of European modernism in a self-consciously historical context. It marked a watershed not only in the history of 20th century modernism, but in its historiography as well. This is nowhere more evident than in the diagram of artistic influences displayed at the exhibition and then printed on the cover of Barr's book, which projects the underlying arguments of the exhibition in a stylized and economical form. On the chart, Cubism appears as a fundamental transition in the history of art. Above it are arrayed the names of important 19th century artists, including Redon, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Cézanne, Seurat, and Rousseau, whose work, in Barr's view, most influenced Cubism and the movements with which it was associated. The lineage that Barr lays out is not simple. Throughout, he asserts a tension between a geometric and an organic tendency constitutive of the modern field, but his chart makes a strong argument for the importance of a historical interpretation of modernism and a specifically chronological understanding of its varied stages. Barr dealt with the relationship between visual forms in art and history in other works, too. During the 1930s and 40s, he used another kind of time chart in internal memos plotting the collecting strategy of the museum. In them, he depicted the MoMA collection as a torpedo, helpfully equipped with a propeller, and moving through time. In the future, Barr suggested, the borders of the modern would gradually advance, leaving various works in its wake. These were then to be donated to the Metropolitan Museum and resituated in a longer history of art. Though roughly drawn, the torpedo diagrams are no less stylized than the cover chart image for Cubism and abstract art, and no less forceful in their argument for a coherent and directional movement in the history of the modern. In one sense, Barr's diagrams were not so different from those he had made in his art history courses at Princeton and Harvard in the 1920s. But his application of these familiar techniques at MoMA was provocative. In presenting the timeline itself as a modernist artifact, Barr suggested a new alliance between the practices of scholarship and those of art. What's more, by combining genealogical and chronological elements in his chart, Barr echoed the tension between the organic and the geometric around which the entire exhibition was organized. Prior to Barr, a few artists had made gestures towards the artistic potential of the art history diagram. In the second decade of the 20th century, while he was editing the Dada Journal 391 and before his turn to surrealism, the Franco-Cuban artist Francis Picabia experimented with the visual vocabulary of the technical diagram. In some instances, he copied directly from technical illustrations found in magazines and manuals. In others, he drew his own playful diagrams, as in the untitled 1919 diagram of modern art that he published in the journal Dada. Picabia's diagram for Dada is not exactly a chronological chart. The relationships that it depicts are thematic and associative, and it lacks a regular measure. Nevertheless, in his selection of graphic elements and arrangement of names, Picabia self-consciously draws on the visual vocabulary of chronography. The relationships depicted are chronological. The names line up with the earliest group, including Ingres, Corot, Cézanne, and Rodin at the bottom, and the latest group, including Braque, Arp, Duchamp, and Zara, arranged in a circle around a clock face at the top, like components of an alarm or a bomb. But the image relies on the viewer to recognize and project implicit relationships, to see in the work an as-if chronological chart. In Picabia's image, the chronological gesture is still implicit, and it would be decades before artists would begin to thematize chronology more commonly. Barr's 1936 chart was both influential and symptomatic. It expressed the growing importance of art history and curatorial practice to the self-conception of modern art. It gestured implicitly to the relationship between art and graphic design that was central to the MoMA project, and it reposed the question of how to negotiate the line between art and non-art that had been so forcefully stated by Dada.
Thank you very much, Tony and Dan, for a fantastic introduction to the book. I think we have time for a couple of questions, if there are questions, and you're willing to take them. If people have questions, we can have a couple of them before we turn to food. Are there questions, in fact? Yeah. Let me give you the mic.
So you began with the Tihi Barber image, and you were saying that it's that you use the part of a football to show a chronology. So it's not actually a chronology, but it becomes one. In a sense, and I'm wondering if there are things that aren't, how do I say this? Give me a moment, sorry. Things that aren't chronologies but look like them. So instead of things that don't look like them but are, the other way around, so things that might borrow from the visual language of chronologies but aren't actually, just in terms of its influence out in the world.
It's a really interesting question. What we've argued is that in the 18th century, chronography, we'll make a distinction between chronology, which is studying the relationship between among dates, and chronography, which is the visual representation of those relationships. So in the 18th century, with Priestley and his contemporaries, chronography really comes into its own and develops its own visual language. And just as cartography, two centuries earlier, had made a massive impact on the European imagination because people saw suddenly in the 15th and 16th centuries that it was possible to portray massive amounts of geographic information in a highly precise and yet intuitive way. So with Priestley and his generation, people saw that you could do the same thing with chronography, with dates. So it was influential, and one of the things that happens quite immediately is the political economist William Playfair says, I can do something like this, but that goes into other dimensions. And he, in 1787, invents the bar chart, the line diagram, and the pie chart, all at once in one work. And all of them he discusses in an analogical relationship to Priestley and the timeline. The same thing happens again a century later with Marais, who is the sort of first theorist of chronophotography, which is the measured taking and then display of photographs, which immediately precedes the invention of cinema. Marais says, wouldn't it be great if we had a way of looking at real pictures that displayed relationships that were like the ones you find on Priestley's charts? And he says, I think there's a way to do it. He says, this is how it might be done. And he says, here's a name, a possible name for it, chronophotography. He takes photo and he wedges it in right between our chronography. So that kind of analogy happens over and over again. And I think that the model of chronography is still very, very lively.
One way to think about this, an image that we use in the book and that we used to show when we first started talking about this, is the great image by Charles Minard of Napoleon's army entering Russia, and then the size of the army charted against time and temperature, getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. But in fact, that's part of our story. I mean, we used it because people were a bit familiar with it. We'd say, see, chronology does that. In fact, he was one of the people who learned from the chronographers. So he's actually part of that larger story, whereas thanks to Tufte and others, he usually sort of comes in, you know, on clouds of cherubs from heaven as if he didn't have a predecessor.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, when a naturalist such as Buffon starts questioning the biblical very short histories of the earth and thinking about the deep history of the earth, does that have an impact on the visual representation of time, or is this more about human history and how that's represented?
Eventually, in the 19th century, there are lots of really interesting representations of deep time in that way. But Priestley has already done something that makes that idea possible, which is that he's placed his figures and his dates into a field which could be extended arbitrarily forward and backward. And once you have that kind of representation of chronology, which is very, very different from the earlier stuff we were showing you, once you have that kind of representation, in a sense, Buffon's argument becomes thinkable. And one of the questions we want to pose, and we certainly haven't answered, is, you know, which comes first, the thought of deep time or the image of temporal extension that you see in these diagrams? Buffon and Priestley are exact contemporaries, and these things are being worked out at the same time. So they influence each other, but no, in Buffon's time, no, these are not used to represent natural history.
One thing we show in the earlier part of the work is that though the universe is supposed to be neat and perfect in time, as it had been supposed to be perfect in space with three continents and three sons of Noah, of course, the cartographic universe got a lot messier once people started sailing around the bottom of Africa and going west, but the chronological universe keeps getting messy too. So one of the most interesting chronologies is done by the cartographer Mercator. And Mercator had read his Plato. And so he knew that Plato had information from Egyptian priests suggesting that Egypt had been around for 10,000 years at the time of the classical period of Athens. And he throws that in a passage in his chronicle, which it really disrupts. It disrupts it only verbally. You have to be able to read the Latin to see that it's there. But there are disruptions in the biblical order of time going right back to Eusebius, who actually found the Greek text that contains the list of Egyptian dynasties in Greek and stuck it in the first book of his chronicle saying, I don't believe this. And what he does is to start his chronological chart after the flood. He says, you just can't do anything before the flood. It's, you know, too many difficulties. So he starts after the flood with the 15th Egyptian dynasty. And in the Renaissance, people start saying, what happened to 1 through 14? And you get, you know, the Talmudic answer is, well, maybe a dynasty is 7 years long. So they all happened after the flood. And you get, so the disrupt, Buffon's deep time, 18th century deep time is different, but there's a sort of earlier deep time, which actually goes back to antiquity and is constantly creating fissures and problems in these works.
We have time for one more question, if there is one. Alex, let's see if I can brave the heights.
Oops, sorry. Okay, it's not fair in a way to ask authors about what's not in the book, but I think it's the only occasion where we really get to. So you started with Eusebius tonight, and I assume that's where the book starts? And the reasons for that, I think, were pretty clear. It's about eschatology. It's about time having a direction and an order, which is, in a way, the precondition for these kinds of representations. But did you toy with the idea of starting somewhere earlier? I'd like you to just rehearse those conversations a little bit.
Started with Eusebius because he is the earliest chronographer in the West whose graphical methods we can actually see. There were Greek chronographers, Roman chronographers. They did all kinds of interesting things. Varro, great Roman scholar, was really worried about when Romulus was born and Rome was founded. There was a lot of debate about that. So he talked to an astrologer friend named Lucius Terutius. And Lucius looked at Romulus's character. He was rather grumpy, you'll remember, kills his brother and all that. So he worked out a horoscope for Romulus's conception, the most absolutely appropriate setting of the planets to create the person Romulus, and gave that as a satisfactory scientific date from which you could then chart the rest of, you know, and that's in the first century BCE. So there's lots of chronological argument. Atticus, the guy Cicero sent all the letters to, created a chronicle. And all we know about it is that Cicero says, it's so cool, your chronicle. All the little guys are marshaled in it like soldiers in an army, which is incredibly suggestive. And there's a wonderful book by Dennis Feeney just came out that puts this evidence together. But we really have no idea what that looked like. Any more than we know what Atticus's map looked like. He also had a world map. So what we decided to do was tell the graphic story that we could tell, which really starts with Eusebius and comes down to the Rose Planetarium and Tate Modern.
Another way of saying the same thing is that this is a book about modernity. And in our concept, Eusebius belongs to modernity. We do make a gesture, a modern gesture, toward the earlier periods. There's an image in the book from Piranesi. It's a 1761 engraving. It's an engraving depicting the chronological tables in fragments in the Roman Forum. So the Romans counted time by who was consul. The consuls rotated in two-year shifts, and so if you knew who was consul, you knew what year it was, and you used names instead of numbers. And so what Piranesi did was he looked at the setup of all of these fragments, and he drew it as a ruin. And what we think about, the way we think about this is that in modernity, for the 18th century, those earlier systems in some fundamental way stopped being thinkable. And so what Piranesi is showing is not just an image of the ruins of Rome, but an image of the ruins of Roman time. And that's more or less the position that our book takes. Modern in the sense that the timeline is modern, right. but who the first is, we would have to look at our sources. Priestley does not put himself on his timeline, but it's really striking because immediately after, his timeline gets plagiarized all over the place, and his name gets taken off of it. It's not attributed to him anymore. 20 years after he's made the chart, it's become so regular as a way of doing history that people don't give him credit for it. But Priestley has become so important in the history of science that he's disappeared from the author line and made it onto the timeline.
But in some way, chronologers often stage their moment as the culmination of time. That's how Eusebius starts. I mean, the point of Eusebius is Constantine has become a Christian. We're going to have a Christian empire. I am, by the way, the bishop of the biggest diocese in this Christian empire. And so things are really good right now. Time has been looking towards this moment. In the 16th century, when chronology is the equivalent of the science humaine in the 1960s, when Joseph Scaliger, a chronologer whom I've studied a lot, was hired at the University of Leiden, the most thrusting hip university in Europe. And when he said, "I don't like to teach," they said, "Fine, just come and write." You know, nobody would do this again until the Collège de France was founded, you know, for real in the 19th century. And this was done for him to do chronology. They paid him more than the law professors. Now, at the end of his first chronology, he dates the completion of the book by him in 40 different eras. You know, Macedonian, Persian, Greek, Roman, Egyptian, many of them wrong, of course, but you know and it's a magnificent narcissistic, you know, it's like the scribe subscription, "Thank God I finished." It goes on for two pages. So yeah, I think narcissism and chronology it's a natural match.
The two statements now. First, a huge thank you to Dan and Tony. Please.